Well, you can take out your copy of God's Word and turn again to the second chapter in Ecclesiastes. And I will admit here at the start that I am perhaps not the most qualified person to speak on this particular subject. Though I think that I have read and understand the point of this paragraph. And while I think I have definitely seen some obvious examples of what Solomon is talking about in this paragraph and others, both as they've got it right and as they've got it wrong, perhaps you might think the connection for me is a little bit strained. I'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But having a career, for me at least, was never really a big desire that I had. In fact, when I was growing up, what I wanted to be was a baseball player. And you see the difference there. They don't ever call them baseball workers. They call them baseball players. And that's what I wanted to be for the majority of my life growing up. I wanted to be a baseball player. Not necessarily because I wanted the big money. It was more so because that's just what I enjoyed. I enjoy the game of baseball, and so that's what I spent most of my time doing. I spent time practicing, preparing for that. And then even the other thing that I wanted to do, which I thought started to come into my mind probably before my senior year of high school, so before I chose a college, before I chose a college major, those kind of things, I thought God was calling me to be a pastor. So even though I went to three different colleges, I never changed my major. From, again, the summer before my senior year of high school until now, I have been pursuing the same thing and am doing it, and that is being a pastor. So I've never had big aspirations for a career in, you know, the business world. And I've had lots of different jobs. Like, I've had plenty of opportunity to test different things out and see if I like them or not. And, I don't. Other than yard mowing, which most people don't consider that at least a lucrative career, I've never really pursued, I've never had great business aspirations. I've never had those kind of opportunities, investment opportunities in my life. I've been paid to be a pastor at one level or another. Some levels were pretty low. And, you know, now I'm very, very content with what I get. So I've never had the aspirations or the opportunities like Solomon. Most of you will probably never have quite the same opportunities, but undoubtedly some of you will have the same goals, or you will be driven by the same kind of ambitions and aspirations that Solomon talks about. This morning we come to examine whether those kind of ambitions and goals can bring you happiness. Now let's think just for a moment where we've been so far, especially as we came into chapter 2. We're talking about Solomon's foray into his attempt into trying to find life, find meaning, and find satisfaction, specifically in all the wrong places. And in chapter 1, verses 12 through 18, we saw the vanity of wisdom. He thought maybe that in his education, in his wisdom, he could find life and meaning and satisfaction and ultimate happiness. And he says it's not in education, it's not in wisdom. In chapter 2, then, verses 1 and 2, he tells us about his search for life and pleasure, in hedonism, in doing whatever would just make him happy. He says that's empty, useless, of no value. Last time we were together, in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 3, we then looked at his trying to find life in alcohol, in a buzz, in making his body happy through some kind of drug, specifically alcohol. And today, in verses 4 through 6, we come to the vanity of work, the vanity of labor. This is, again, in this larger section of looking for life, looking for meaning, trying to find happiness, a happiness in your heart from all these different things. And like I said today, the vanity of work. There are four parts to Solomon's pursuit of pleasure through work that we're going to see, Solomon's report, Solomon's projects, Solomon's, thirdly, his motive, and then his conclusion. And first then, his report. Look at chapter 2, verse 4. I made great works. I made great works. We'll see the rest here in these final 3 points. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. And some of you are perhaps thinking, how in the stink could you get an entire sermon out of those verses? Well, you're about ready to find out. The very first sentence there is Solomon's report. I made great works. It introduces us to this next test in Solomon's quest to find meaning in life under the sun. It's an account, it's a description, and the rest of what follows in verses 4 through 6 begins with this, I made great works. All three of these verses are his written report. You know, this is like, your teacher asked you to write a report. Here it is. It starts out with the beginning. He's introducing it to us. He says, I made great works. And the rest of the verses will go on and fill that out to paint that picture a little bit more. And this is an account of his investigation into the possibility that work, that projects could bring him meaning and satisfaction to life. Maybe we would say Solomon was looking to find fulfillment in achievements, in significant accomplishments, something that he had been successful at, doing something well. This is the point of these verses, his work, his accomplishments, his achievements. That's what he's testing here to see if he could find fulfillment in self-motivated architectural and agricultural projects. Of course, the subject of work has already been mentioned by the preacher. In fact, if you go back to chapter 1, verse 3, in this introductory poem that he gives, he's already mentioned work in this rhetorical question, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? You got the emphasis of the toil, the work, the labor, and that rhetorical question is meant to give us what answer? What does a man gain for all of that work? What is the answer? Nothing, and then you die. So really, he's already, given us this conclusion earlier in chapter 1. But don't misunderstand, it is good to work. And I want to make that clear because I don't want any of you, especially you guys who tend towards laziness, I don't want any of you guys to walk out of here thinking, hey, work is vain. It's empty. So I'll just sit here, man. That's not the point of what he's saying. He's not encouraging us not to work. And I'll be saying that a couple times throughout the passage. In fact, turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. I actually went through, I thought about taking time to just go through and mention every verse in Ecclesiastes that talks about toil or work, because there's a lot of them. And most of them are giving instructions on how to work. They're not saying don't work. In fact, there's no verse that says don't work anywhere in the Bible. Okay, and even then in chapter 11, verses 3 through 4 are all about work. He says, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a portion to 7 or to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. I promise you this does actually relate to work. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth, and if a tree falls to the south or to the north in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. If a tree falls in the forest, does it make any sound? It's one of those kind of questions. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. And here in verses 5 and 6, then, he helps us understand what he said. As you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in a womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. And so therefore, do your work and invest properly and trust that God is going to take care of what he's supposed to take care of. And verse 6, in the morning sow your seed, and at evening withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. He's saying, some of you just look at the sky and say, you know, it might rain, it might not rain. If a tree falls in the forest, if it falls to the north or the south, should I then do my work? I'm concerned about where the tree might fall. I'm not sure. He's saying, no, stop all that consideration and get to work. Get to work. Perhaps the clearest verse in all of Ecclesiastes that makes the same point is in chapter 9, verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Now, he gives the reason for that. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom and shield to which you are going. That is, when life is done, there's no more work. Now is the time to work. Whatever your hand finds to do, give it your best. Work as hard as possible. Do what is right. Of course, not only in Ecclesiastes, but the Proverbs, many of which are written by Solomon, are full of exhortations to work. In fact, one of Solomon's greatest foils, that is one of his greatest objects to criticize, is the lazy man. Maybe you remember a few months ago when I preached in big church on that Sunday night, consider the ant. You know, go to the ant, O sluggard. Get to work. There is nothing inherently wrong with work or with even working to get, you know, the things that you need, and even occasionally working to get nice things. Those who are gifted should use their opportunities. They should use and enjoy their opportunities to work. And you know what? All of us are called to work in some way. Guys, you're generally going to be called to work to provide for your family. And ladies, you are called to work in your family, for your family as well, just at home. Guys have to work and ladies have to work. Work is what God has made us for. In fact, God worked, right? When God created, and on the seventh day, he rested from all the work that he had done. So that's to provide a pattern for us. We work for 6 days, at least for the Israelites, work for the 6 days, and they rested on the Sabbath day. So we are to set apart a day for worship. It's not exactly the same as the Sabbath, but the principle is there's work and there's rest. That's the rhythm of life. We work hard, we give it our best, and then we rest. And we acknowledge God in all those things. Well, here's the point that Solomon's making in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. If your work is your life, your life is going to be empty. If your accomplishments and your achievements and your projects are what you're looking for to make you happy in life, you are always going to be disappointed. All of the success ladder, all of the success, all of the ladder climbing, all of the achievements, all of the bank accounts, all of the toys that you get for yourself, all of the fulfillment that you come in the completion of a project, if that is what you're looking for to give you meaning in life, you will always be disappointed. Solomon reports here in verses 4 through 6 that he was actually responsible for some amazing things, but that even those accomplishments did not bring him that joy, that meaning, that satisfaction in life that he was looking for. And as I said, even though most of us won't have those kinds of opportunities like the king would have, the amount of resources, opportunities that as King Solomon had. Most of us won't have those kind of opportunities on that kind of level. And yet, his experience has direct application for those career-minded, workaholic kind of people who think life is in their labor, who think that they're defined by their work, they're defined by their accomplishments and their achievements. Well, let's look at his project, secondly. His report, I made great works, just kind of introducing to us the rest of what's coming. Then his projects, the second part of verse 4 through verse 6. I built houses, I planted vineyards for myself, I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Now, first, if you know anything about Solomon's life, what stands out to you in reading those few verses is that not all of the things Solomon did are mentioned here. Only some of the projects that he worked on are mentioned in these verses. In fact, turn back to 1 Kings chapter 7. Just point out a couple things. One of the projects, at least, that he mentions in Ecclesiastes 2 is mentioned here in verse 1. Solomon was building his own house 13 years. We're working on that at my house. It might take 13 years to finish that project. And he finished his entire house. Verse 2, he built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits and its breadth 50 cubits and its height 30 cubits. And it was built on four rows of cedar pillars with cedar beams on the pillars. And it was covered with cedar above the chambers that were on the 45 pillars, 15 in each row. There were window frames in three rows and window opposite window in three tiers. All the doorways and windows had square frames, and window was opposite window in three tiers, which I'm not exactly sure what all that means. It seems to me that it's describing that not only the footprint of the house, but it's also describing that there were like different floors in the house. It seems to me that's what it's describing. By the way, this is not his house. This is another house for him. Okay. And I did just real quick calculations that this house, just in its footprint, so if there were two floors or three floors, I don't know. It only increases this number. But just the footprint of this house was over 11,000 square feet. Now, those of you who have been to my house is 3,000 square feet. And this other house that was not the one that he was living in Jerusalem was over 11,000 square feet and might have had more levels, which could have only increased that. If there are three levels, which I think that's what it's trying to say, then the house would have had approximately 33,000 square feet of like livable space in it. That's a big house. The Weinbergs are building a house, and I think their house is a little bit over 5,000 square feet. So 33,000 square feet is a big house. And he made the Hall of Pillars, verse 6. Its length was 50 cubits and its breadth 30 cubits. There was a porch in front with pillars and a canopy in front of them. He made the Hall of the Throne, where he was to pronounce judgment. Even the Hall of Judgment, it was finished with cedar from floor to rafters. His own house, where he was to dwell in the other court, back of the hall, was of like workmanship. Solomon also made a house like this, a hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken in marriage. All these were made of costly stones, cut according to measure, sawed with saws back and front, even from the foundation to the coping, and from the outside to the great court. Now, a couple of these projects are what he talks about in Ecclesiastes 2. At least three or four of these, he's not even referring to. These halls where he can judge, the halls for other things, those aren't even mentioned in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Look over at chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 17. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer and lower Beth Horon and Baaloth and Tamar in the wilderness in the land of Judah. By the way, those are cities. He rebuilt cities. Verse 19, and all the store cities that Solomon had, and the cities for his chariots. You kind of think that must be a misprint to say that cities is plural there for his chariots. He built many cities for his chariots. And the cities for his horsemen. I'm hoping that like the horsemen and the chariots were like close together. Maybe they had to commute to work. I don't know. And whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. Now, of course, in all of that, we still haven't mentioned the fact that Solomon was also responsible for building what building? The temple. Now, I got to tell you, that just kind of makes me tired. I mean, we've been basically working, and I use we very liberally, okay? We have been working on Mo and I's master bedroom off and on for 2 years. And as of this point, the walls are painted. We have electricity, the walls are painted, and like there's a quarter of the wood flooring down and still has left to be floored, and then it has to be sanded and then stained and then finished, and then we have to put up all the trim, and then we have to put in the cabinets, and we got to put in the plumbing, and we got to then like make the bed and put the bed in there and like hang things up before it's done, let alone then the rest of the, you know, 2,500 square feet left to go in the house. So, you know, I'm thinking about that. And, of course, you know, we're trying to do most of the work ourselves. Solomon was not doing the work by his own hands, right? But that's actually a pretty decent amount to be responsible for. I would think the temple would have been enough, let alone your own house that took you 13 years, let alone then to build yourself some other houses, let alone to, you know, rebuild some cities while you're at it. And a place, you know, a city hall where you can judge and all those kind of things. That's a lot. Now, back in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, perhaps some of the reasons that he doesn't say here, you know, I made great works, that kind of summarizes all of that. But then he specifically says, I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. Perhaps the reason why he doesn't talk about the cities and the other buildings and the temple is because he's referring more to the things, the buildings he built for himself, for pleasure. Still saying that was many. But I think this is more than just about then having a nice house for him to go be in. I think it was the process he's talking about here. In verses 4, 5, and 6, I think he's talking about these projects as giving him meaning and satisfaction. The pleasure of producing, the pleasure of working. I say that because it's in verses 7 and 8 that he really gets into his possessions and his riches. You know, when he says, verse 7, I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I think he's talking about his wealth. That'll be the next part, the vanity of wealth. And how wealth and riches can't satisfy you. Here, I don't think he's talking about the actual object of what he gets. I think he's talking about the process, the vanity of the work. Now, even though we don't know exactly how much Solomon did with his own hands, he was probably more like his own general contractor, right? you know, with subcontractors. Didn't call them that. It probably called them slaves. You know, and then the worker people. But undoubtedly, he was involved. He is taking credit for these. So, to various degrees of involvement, he was a part of this. Expended his own energy in whatever ways to make it happen. And the plurals here definitely emphasize the magnificence and the amount of stuff that he did. Three kind of things here. Houses, gardens, and pools is how I divided it up. I really looked for some cool other way to outline it, but three projects that he undertakes. Houses, gardens, and pools. Architecture, horticulture, and engineering. I know that does engineering-ture. Okay, so the last part of verse 4, I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. This is his work, his stepping out into the sphere of architecture, the art or practice of designing and constructing buildings. This is not just then the buildings themselves, but finding the right properties, property management, construction, location selection. Then, you know, from the design, you know, coming up with the plans and the blueprints all the way to the building itself. Maybe he even got a little bit into the interior design of it. You know, his color palettes and his fabric swatches. And, you know, undoubtedly he was into that. You know, and he has his servants bring him all the different things to choose from. And, you know, maybe he liked to, maybe he went crazy in one room. And he went conservative in another room just to see what he liked. You know, you get the impression that here was a guy who was, you know, trying to do something significant. He built houses for his wives, houses for traveling. I mean, this is not a guy who would rent a hotel room when he went to various parts of his kingdom. You know? Somebody probably would have planned, you know, planned his schedule out enough to build him a house for when he got there. They didn't have hotels anyway, but, you know, he was not going to stay at somebody's house. I mean, this was a guy who either took it with him or had it built for him so that when he arrived, you know, it would be just like he wanted it. Houses for vacation, little R&R. You know, some downtime, getting away from it all to unwind. And, of course, included with the houses, he mentions he planted vineyards for himself. Vineyards probably were for the purpose of helping him unwind as well. We already looked at the vanity of that in verse 3. So houses were one of his projects, but then secondly, I mean, he separates it out, gardens. He says, verse 5, I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. This is horticulture, the art or practice of garden cultivation and management. We might call it landscaping. I made myself gardens and parks. That Solomon was fond of gardening, we get from all of his references to different kinds of trees and plants in the Song of Solomon. You read through that, you know, he's always using some kind of plant or tree or flower to describe his love or, you know, the other person or himself or whatever it is. The word gardens in Hebrew and in some of the other comparative languages typically seems to refer to a garden enclosed by a wall. So protected then from the outside, protected from wild animals, protected from people who would come in and try to destroy it or steal various things from it. You kind of get the picture of a pleasure ground, you know, where you just walk through the garden for, you know, relaxation and enjoyment. Gardens, in fact, were the pride of kings and nobility in the ancient Near East. I mean, it's not like you were going to go, you know, watch a movie with all your buddies when they came over. You know, after dinner, what would you do? Well, you'd take a stroll through your own garden, and then you could show off to everybody, you know, here's such and such, you know. We've been growing this for 5 years. Look how lovely and pretty it is. See, I don't get into that a whole lot, so if sounds like I'm mocking that just a little bit, I like grass, okay? I realize that that shows my lack of taste, perhaps, but I like grass. I don't need lots of trees and flowers and shrubbery. I want grass. I want nice grass, green grass, and a lot of it. Okay? But I understand that there are people who like, you know, roses and tulips and gardenias and, you know, you got to have the right amount of ground cover and, you know, you need the ones that you can shape nicely and, you know, your shade trees. And then he's talking specifically about all kinds of fruit trees. I mean, can you imagine the kind of smell that would be in this protected, nice garden? I mean, everything is green. You got maybe some citrus smell, you know, from those kinds of fruits. And you got your, you know, your apples. I mean, if you've been in an orchard before, there's a great kind of sweet smell to that. Let alone the beauty, but the smell, I mean, all the senses. And then, you know, you're out there and, you know, it's time to eat. So you take it off the tree and, you know, you mow into it. Certainly with all kinds of these fruit trees, he was diversifying, showing off his different tastes and abilities. Then third, the pools. He's got houses, gardens, and pools. Verse 6, I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. Here was his engineering feats. Not only were the pools intended probably to look at for beauty, specifically these pools were meant for the sake of irrigation. So beyond these gardens and these parks, he planted entire forests. This is the original Johnny Appleseed, okay? He's planting forests, and he's not just wandering throughout throwing seeds all over the place. Like, you imagine these things are in rows or however it happened, and he's now got then these great big pools of water then to organize it to irrigate things with, you know, no electricity, no concrete, no whatever. I mean, imagine the ingenuity, the creativity, the wisdom that it would take to make that happen. I mean, people today have entire jobs. They're called civil engineers, where they work on roads and public projects, and they deal with rivers and ponds and all those kinds of things to manage them. So Solomon builds these pools not only for the beauty, but for, again, work, for watering these forests. It's estimated, based on some of the pools that are still outside Jerusalem and some of the ones that they think were there, that the pools that he created, at least the ones in Jerusalem, probably held over 40 million gallons of water. And, of course, it was not just for the environment, okay? It was not making these forests of trees for the environment. It was not a Greenpeace tree hugger lover. I mean, why would you make trees? So you could make more houses and make some ships and make instruments and all the different kinds of things that you do with wood. They didn't have plastic, so you made stuff out of wood. I mean, this was for business sake, not just for the sake of the environment. These aqueducts, these waterworks were amazing feats of engineering. Houses, gardens, pools. He did all of that. But that brings us to his motive in the third point, Solomon's report, his projects. Third, his motive. And this is found in verses 4, 5, and 6. There's a word there that's repeated. What's the word? Yeah, myself. Verse 4. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. Verse 5. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. Verse 6. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. His motive was himself. And I'm going to break it up into two parts of self, pleasure and pride. Pleasure for himself and pride in himself. I mean, pleasure is the overarching theme in chapter 2 anyway, the pursuit of pleasure. He said as much in verses 1 and 2. Then verse 3, he's getting pleasure for himself from alcohol. Now he's trying to get pleasure for himself from the work and then from the object of the work. Undoubtedly, these houses and these gardens and things were intended to give him pleasure, to make him happy. Try to get pleasure from the work itself and then in the result of the work. For recreation, for relaxation and leisure. And then just for the joy of completing a project. I mean, you know how that is. There is a lot of pleasure when something is done. Most of us get pleasure out of doing something that's not a good job as long as it's done. Let alone doing it excellently to the best that we can. We're just happy to give the research paper to the teacher and get it out of our hands. But more than pleasure is pride. I mean, a sense of self-fulfillment and satisfaction from doing this work. I mean, all of these achievements reflected his power and his riches and his royalty and his creativity. And like I said, his ingenuity, his wisdom, all of these things showed off him. Whether they were to visiting royalty and kings from other countries, or whether they were to the people of Israel, or just for himself, they showed off him. He was leaving his legacy here, or establishing it at least. Just so you know, this is not a crazy thing. I mean, I think you can imagine how this would be possible for Solomon to be motivated by his pride here to show himself off. In Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, you don't need to go there. King Nebuchadnezzar is talking, and this is how he describes his work. He says, "The king answered and said, 'Is not this great Babylon, which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty?'" This would be a typical thing for kings to show off their power and their riches by building all these great things. Nebuchadnezzar did the same and said as much in Daniel chapter 4. Solomon undoubtedly prided himself on his refined tastes and his elegant choices. But I tell you what, he was serving himself. He was not doing it for the greater good. He was not certainly not doing it for God. He was doing it for himself. Interesting quote from a guy whose name is Helmut. Most people pronounce his last name Tielich. "An architect built many houses, cities, and squares, but no one could learn his art or match his skill until several people persuaded him to teach them. When they had learned it, they quarreled with him and set up as architects themselves at lower prices. Then the people stopped admiring the original architect and gave their commission to the apprentices. In the same way, God has created you in his own image and likeness, but now that you, like him, have created marvelous things, it will be said, 'There is no God in the world apart from you.'" And that's exactly what was happening here with Solomon, is that in accomplishing all of these great works, who was he forgetting? The one who gave him the position and the riches and the opportunities in the first place. He was setting himself up and his own majesty and his own greatness, priding himself in his own achievements and his own accomplishments. And I tell you what, Solomon found no satisfaction and meaning in his work because his motives were wrong. In all of his labor, he had forgotten God. And that brings us to Solomon's conclusion, number four, his report, his projects, his motive, and now his conclusion. And though his conclusion does not come explicitly in verses 4 through 6, we do find his conclusion on work in the context. And it's a lie that you're going to find fulfillment in your work in and of itself. Look down at chapter 2, verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Look down at verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun. Remember now, as he's near the end of his life, he's looking back over all that has taken place. Maybe he's even looking at some of the great works he had done, and he says, seeing that I must leave it to a man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. Solomon had become wrapped up in his work. He poured all his efforts and skill and wisdom into his achievements. But rather than finding satisfaction in them, he was disillusioned. Rather than bring him peace, all that he had done for himself brought restlessness. A man named Sinclair Ferguson notes, quote, "It sounds all too like the random thoughts of a modern businessman during a session with his psychotherapist. Look at the vocabulary which dominates the description of his work: meaningless, chasing, hated, toiled, despair, anxious striving, pain, and grief." I mean, where are the happy people today? Where are the happy multimillionaires? Where are the happy celebrities with all of their achievements and accomplishments? They're not happy because those things are empty. Instead of being satisfied with what Solomon accomplished, he always felt like he needed to do more. Always be expanding. And I tell you what, it's not like we don't know that it's empty, right? I mean, if you really stop and think about it for a moment, you know that those things don't bring ultimate satisfaction. I mean, I take great pride in my ability to mow a yard, okay? I do it, and I give my best to mow a yard. And you know what? Then it grows back. And I got to do it again. And that's okay. I mean, I like the process, but ultimately, you know, you can look at how great your yard looks basically for the rest of the day. Once it goes through the night, even the next morning, generally it doesn't look as good as it did right after you cut it. So you got maybe a couple hours, you know, where you can really admire what worked there. You know, and maybe it's something else. Maybe, you know, it's your house that you build, or it's another project that you make. You know, it's your little paper mache volcano with baking soda and vinegar, you know, for your science project, Brian Regan. And, you know, you really admire that, and then, you know, that's boring. None of those things last. They might bring a temporary amount of pleasure, but not a lasting pleasure. And yet some of you are so panicked because you don't know what to do with your life. And to some extent, you know, we need to be considering and thinking about what God would have us do for our work. But you know what? If you are looking to your work to bring life satisfaction, you are not going to find a job that will do that. So stop putting so much pressure on the job. God is the only one who can bring you satisfaction no matter what your job is. I'm not saying you shouldn't work to do something that you like to do. Obviously, there are certain things that bring us more pleasure than others. Like I said before, I've had lots of jobs. I hated them all. This job, being a pastor, is the thing that I enjoy. I like my job being a pastor. I don't want to do anything else. But you know what? My job as a pastor can be filled with just as many vain things if I'm looking for satisfaction in the job and not in God. My job can be vain and empty. My preaching messages, studying and preaching, my making a website, my doing bulletins, snow retreats, events, whatever, all of that can be absolutely vain if that's what I'm looking for to find satisfaction, even in my job. So, you know, my job, which is supposed to be, you know, a Bible job, just being a Christian for a living, you know, if that's not going to bring satisfaction and joy, then obviously other things are not going to bring satisfaction and joy that don't even claim in and of themselves to be doing anything with God. Work in and of itself will not satisfy you. We ought to work. Business itself is a good thing. Having a career, most of you are going to do that, or you're going to work at home. You know, guys, you're going to have a job. You're going to make money for your family. Ladies, if you get married, you're going to work at home. You got work to do. You ought to work as hard as you can. God is glorified when we use our gifts and our talents to employ others or to be employed, to make things, to build buildings, to invest, to borrow and build and earn interest and all those kinds of things. God has entrusted us with tools and expects us to use them in a way that honors him. But that's the key, isn't it? In a way that honors him, not in a way to make ourselves satisfied and to please ourselves. When we give so much attention to this world, we cannot help but have our loves be in this world. And our loves are to be in another world. We are to work in this world for loves in another world. Do you know that? Work and work hard, but for sake of a love in another world, beyond the sun. Again, this is more than just an issue of the kind of work you do. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 12. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. I mean, bookwork. From bookwork to building houses, in and of themselves, are wearisome and empty if God is not in it. So how can you work right? This is going to be quick. How can you work right? How can you work and have accomplishments and achievements and not have your life be in those accomplishments and achievements. First is your motive. We saw that with Solomon. Whether you are doing it to please yourself or to please God, your motive is crucial. Secondly, your dependence. Are you depending on yourself and your own wisdom and your own strength? All that's going to do is bring anxiety. Or are you depending on God and His wisdom and His empowerment? Your motive, your dependence. Third, your perspective. Are you having the perspective that you are called to work and you can even enjoy that work? You can enjoy the process? Or for you, is it all about there's no joy in it until you finish it? I tell you what, if you don't get any joy in the process, you're going to be a pretty miserable person, because most of the time it doesn't get finished. At least big projects don't get finished. So motive, dependence, perspective, timing. Knowing when to work and when work has become your addiction, workaholism. Your timing on when you work. If all of your time is spent trying to accomplish projects and you miss out on other things that God has called you to, like rest, like ministry, like family, those are not in that order. I'm just saying, including other things, your timing of work is crucial. There is a time to work and a time not to work, or at least not work on the same things. Timing your object, that is what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, there are some jobs that you can do that obviously are not tending to glorify God. I mean, if your job is to be a thief, okay, not one of those that's in the right category, because you did that with all your heart. Okay? So there are jobs that by their definition, they are wrong, sinful things, not the best things. So your object of work, and then your effort, being lazy or being diligent. If you're just working and going through the motions, that's not pleasing to God either. You're to work and to work hard, but not for yourself. You know what the trouble here is? It can look the exact same on the outside, and only you may know. Only you may know what the motivation in your heart is for why you work. Of course, as many people as there are that you can't tell what's going on, for other people you can see and tell what's going on, that their life is all wrapped up in work. But for all the dangers that work brings with it, the answer is not to not work. The answer is not to avoid work. The answer is to work with a Godward perspective as servants of God, dependent on God, giving thanks to God. I got to tell you what, I'm almost done, number one. But number two, I am very impressed and thankful for the examples that we have here on the 128 staff of men and women who work and who work right. Some of them maybe have jobs that they like more than others, but these are people who work, and it does not become workaholism. These are people who work and work to the best that they can, but then they don't forget ministry, and they don't forget their family, their spouses, their kids. They don't forget those things, and you ought to see their example. So many people today, so many people in the church are wrapped up in work, and it doesn't bring them peace and rest. It brings them anxiety and restlessness, sleeplessness. It doesn't bring them satisfaction. You ought to get in the back pockets of, you ladies ought to get in the back pockets of the moms who work and, you know, manage the house things well and their kids. You ought to see how they balance those things together. You guys ought to see, you know, the ones who are working in various kinds of jobs and see how they do it with work and ministry and family. It's a tough thing. It's not easy for them. And yet it's their commitment to work right and to not get satisfaction in their life, to not have work be their life. Eating and drinking, buying, selling, planting, and building, those are all parts of the rhythm of life. They're each necessary in various degrees, but you know what? They will not satisfy you in and of themselves. That's Solomon's testimony. Work is from God. Work is not to be God. You work to serve God, not to serve work. Work hard, depend on God, enjoy the process, seek your treasure in heaven. As I said before, we work in this world for love in another world. That ought to be the case. Father, help us in all the various decisions we have every day. The choices, the priorities, all those things. Perhaps even for some of the students who are imagining what their life will be 5, 10, 15 years from now. Some of them undoubtedly are imagining what their life will be like, how great it will be when they have the job that they want, making the money that they want. Yet those ideals are not what satisfy. You alone satisfy. Keep our perspective beyond the sun, not stuck under the sun. And we pray all this in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.